And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. You do know, if you've listened to us for any length of time, that we're here on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. on this fine station, as well as podcasting on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, as well as Player FM, Blueberry, and a bunch of others that folks are linking us to. And hey, thanks if you've done that. Greatly appreciated. Sharing the links to the playlists, sharing the links to the interviews, as well as going to our guests' website by clicking on that little grocery cart on the SoundCloud player while you're listening to the interview to find out more about our guest, what the work is that they're doing, and to get more involved and to continue your evolutionary process. And if you like what we're doing here, you'd like to support us financially, we do have a PayPal and Patreon account, and they are on the homepage as well as the missions page. Maybe this is the first time you've listened to the program and you want to find out a little bit more about us as you listen to these interviews. You can go to that page and at the bottom, boom, there are the links to support us financially. And we thank those who have supported us financially. We thank those who will. And we thank you for supporting us energetically as you listen to these programs and as well go to our guest website. So with all of that said, another reminder to you that 2020 is the year of perfect vision. That is what we're promoting for 2020. And we're talking about inner vision. And we want you to have that perfect vision. Just join us, join our guests. They're going to share with you ways to achieve that perfect vision, to see the world through that perfect vision, that inner vision. And that's kind of what we talk about on a regular basis on this program. So thank you so much for being a part of that campaign that we've launched. And we are going to go on now to our guest who is with us via the phones from all the way from New York, the state of New York. And she's written a book called Peace, Love, Action, Everyday Acts of Goodness from A to Z, and her name is Tanya Zabinski, and I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard.
You've put this wonderful little work together, and you have given us something seriously to think about because, you know, within certain philosophies, they talk about the one rule or law or commandment, if you will, is that of love. But it doesn't do a whole lot of good unless you put it into action. Do something with it, as it were. Show people, show people that you really care. And that's really what you're talking about. It's and then, of course, the other part of this piece, it has to do with that inner peace that goes along with the inner vision that I mentioned earlier, because I've often heard over the years, we want world peace. You know, we want peace in the Middle East. We want peace here, there, and everywhere. And I've always heard it said that that will never come unless we have peace within. It's not an external peace that we have to foster. It's an internal one, right?
I agree. And it's all connected. The inner peace is connected with the outer peace. And I like what you said in the beginning of your show, too, about vision. And I'm so happy that I'm on your show because that is what my book is about. Well, the vision of a world, a loving, peaceful, thriving world that works for all.
Mm-hmm.
that vision does good if it's just a vision. We have to move towards getting that vision. And so my book tells stories of people who hold the vision, who move towards creating it, and then it asks the question, you know, how can we use our gifts, our challenges, our life experiences to evolve the direction of that vision?
You sound like a very young individual. And you don't have to tell me how old you are. That would be rude of me to ask that, as they say. But
well, I don't mind saying I'm 50. What is it? 56. I lose track. But I just think of myself really in an ageless kind of way because I think all through your life you can be. ideally learning and growing and evolving.
Mm. Well, now you go from A to Z, and of course, you have in the book here. I love this one page, just a simple page, a hand holding up a sign that says "Equal Rights for All." And every individual matters. Every individual has a role to play. Every individual makes a difference. What I find interesting in our day and age is that there are certain, certain groups of people who feel that their group is more important than the whole. Or maybe I'm misreading that, and I would love for you to touch upon this, because we're going to talk about the aspect of activism as we move forward. But it just seems to me like, at least that's kind of what I hear, I'm not even going to mention the movements or activist groups, but you know what I'm saying? It's like... You said everything. It's all interconnected, and so are we. You and I are both interconnected, regardless of what group we might associate with. My group is, from my perspective, Tanya, my group isn't any more or less important than yours.
I agree, but I also feel that through history, different groups have been oppressed and treated as though they don't matter as much. And so I think they're just saying, hey, you know, we matter. And, it's easy, I think, when you've been in a group that is, you know, treated with respect and treated like they matter, it might be easy to say that it might be easy to feel like, yeah, we all matter. But if you were treated, like you didn't matter, you would just want to stand up and say, hey, yes, I do matter. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And at the same time, we don't, I find that we tend to get lost in our group. As I know you're very much aware, there is the phrase that's going around, and I didn't coin it by any means, tribalism, that you have. And again, it's kind of like the group. So we have our own tribes. And it does seem that every group matters, every individual matters, but it's almost... there's almost a sort of a. Am I mistaken in my observations that there's almost a bitterness and almost a seeking revenge to the extent that my group has been oppressed longer than your group, so I should get special consideration before you get special consideration. I was actually thinking about that from a historical perspective, trying to figure out. Okay, which group has been oppressed the longest? Some would say the Jews, going back to the Old Testament and 4,000 or 6,000 years ago, or however long it was. Some might say on this continent it would be the Native Americans. Others would say it's the Africans. Others would say it's the Chinese, the Irish when they were building the railroads, and they were sort of enslaved. Children, in the 18 and early 1900s before labor laws were enacted in this country. I mean, the list goes on. Women, because they weren't allowed to vote until the early 1900s. And the list goes on. How do you parse all that out to help people get focused on what's really important when it comes to, and I guess I need to use this word that you've used, when it comes to being an activist, getting involved in making this world a better place for everyone?
Well, I think it helps to have a vision of what you're aiming for. Are you aiming for revenge or are you aiming for, equality? If you know that you're aiming for equality and harmony and peace, all those things, then it helps you it helps you get there. Just like when you have a GPS and you put in your destination, you know, it helps you get there. And so same thing, if you have a vision, it's like it helps you know what you're aiming for in order to get there.
Mm-hmm. And it isn't a single answer to that question, what are we aiming for? Because each tribe, I'm going to use that term regardless of what it may describe, each tribe has to decide what it is that what is it that we really want? What is it that we're really out here protesting or holding up signs or getting involved in the political system or getting involved in the educational or religious or economic or whatever the other systems are, the other institutions are? There isn't just one answer. You have to go. But who do you go to, or do you just have to figure that out for yourself? But then doesn't that, if you're just going in there solo, doesn't that then sort of create a splinter within that tribe? Because now everybody has their own goal, their own intention, and that group is no longer really cohesive because everybody's, so to speak, out for themselves. Every man for every man or woman or child for themselves.
Well, every issue has its nuances, and you know, it's getting maybe just a little abstract because we're just talking in generality.
Sure. No, absolutely. I want to keep it that way because there is no one answer for all of the tribes, if, again, using that term.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved in activism?
Well, like a lot of people, I feel like I wanted to contribute something to the world with my life, and I often felt like I'm not doing something for the greater good. Our kids are grown now, but when they were at home, sometimes I just felt like I was just involved in the daily, you know, getting things done and going here and going there and paying the bills, and I felt like I was all consumed with sort of myself rather than, you know, bigger things in the world. And this project came out as a kind of effort to, well, one, do more, but also reframe life, because sometimes the day-to-day actions is what really does make a difference. You know, there's the little picture and there's the big picture, and they are connected. And so one of the stories I tell is, we live outside Buffalo. It's very snowy. One particular winter, we had so much snow, and every day seemed to be shoveling. And I told my 12-year-old son, as we were shoveling, you know, when am I ever going to do something worthwhile? And the next day we were out shoveling again, and he said to me, Mom, when are we going to do something worthwhile? And when it came from his lips, it sounded so different to me, and I realized that, just to be alive and just to have the ability to shovel, not everyone can do that, and just to see the beauty of the brightness of the snow and having a driveway to shovel, like, I could be thankful for all these things. And to be with my son, you know, he lives in another city right now, and, you know, like, that was a precious time, and instead of appreciating it, I was thinking of, you know, what more can I do? And so, I wasn't lifting anyone out of poverty by shoveling, but also there's a mental poverty that I was contributing towards, feeling like, you know, I'm not doing enough. And so part of action is also what you're contributing. You use the word energetically. you know, what are you contributing energetically? What kind of energy are you putting out there? Are you putting out there complaining energy, or are you putting out there appreciative energy, full of gratitude and joy for just being alive? And so, you know, action isn't just being at the front of a march or writing letters to the editor. It's also day-to-day, how you treat yourself, how you treat other people, how you treat the earth. You know, where you, it can be where you buy your groceries, even where you buy your books. You know, going local, go local is one of the, well, the full title of the book is Peace, Love, Action, Everyday Acts of Goodness from A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
So go local is one of the acts of goodness. And Alice Waters is the person who represents that action. And she's a proponent of the global movement, especially around food. She advocates for people to get local, seasonal, organic when you can. And when you do that, you're, well, for one, you're getting food that isn't old and from far away, so it'll probably taste better. You're supporting local agriculture. You're also not spending a lot of the energy transporting your food. And so it's good for you. It's good for the planet. It's good for your local economy. And so those kinds of actions, like I said, you're not at the front of a march, but those are actually peaceful actions that you can take that honor the earth and honor the farmers who grew the food and honor your body. And so I was reframing those kinds of things as also being activist things in addition to things like, well, another person in the book is Martin Luther King Jr.,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, was at the forefront of the civil rights movement. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways to be a peaceful activist. And in the book, there are all kinds of people from, a preacher, a nun, a monk, a scientist, athlete, farmer, you know, all different kinds of people. And so we don't have to be standing at a podium. You know, we can be activists in our everyday lives, although we might one day stand at a podium and, you know, be a politician or, you know, do things that are, I think, traditionally considered more activist type of things. That was a long answer.
No, that's fine. No, we have plenty of time. You and your husband founded Elwood Avenue Arts Festival there in Buffalo, New York. And, of course, for the past 25 years, you've been running Planet Love. You have a website, actually, which is called planetlovedesigns.com, where people can get some of the artwork. Now, is this artwork that you have done or that you have just been able to convert to posters and or T-shirts and things of this nature to kind of allow people to purchase and sort of make their own statement, if you will, through that?
It's my artwork, and by putting it on T-shirts and clothing, it does make it into a kind of a, walking art gallery.
It's very interesting how, especially, I kind of feel like I have maybe only just a little bit of a sense of what was going on in the 1960s. And again, I was born in 1960, so I'm just about 60 years of age, but really didn't have any real awareness until maybe in the 70s of what was happening back then. But I'm starting to get a sense of that here in the 20-teens, as we're actually coming close to the end of the 20-teens, here we are, 2020, the year of perfect vision. But I'm noticing that, and especially after the 2016 election, I saw all these people out protesting, and I can appreciate their frustration, their anger, their whatever it is, the reasons they were out there. But I could never understand how what they were asking for was going to be achieved by them out there screaming, yelling, carrying signs, and quote-unquote protesting. Help me to understand why that kind of peaceful gathering, and we want to keep it that way, why is a peaceful gathering such as that, where people, you know, feel a particular way about a particular issue and what have you, because a lot of these, especially when you start looking around the world, sometimes they turn ugly. Sometimes the governments, fortunately, our government hasn't started doing this, at least I haven't seen that. Hopefully I haven't been blind to it. Sometimes the governments step in and say, no, you're not going to do that. That's not appropriate. Go away or we will do things to you that you won't like. But what about that aspect of being an activist and standing up for a particular cause that you strongly believe in? How effective is that group gathering? What does it accomplish?
Well, there's a quote from Gandhi, and he says, in regards to people we have a hard time getting along with, that we should not attack them, demean them, or even disrespect them. Because if you want reconciliation, if you're disrespecting someone, it's not going to encourage reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And then Martin Luther King, he did put that into action, and a lot of the civil rights movement, they based a lot of their actions on the ideas of Martin Luther, the ideas of Gandhi. And so, okay, for instance, the lunch counter sit-ins, the freshman four, they started off at the Woolworth lunch counter, and where they weren't allowed to be served, and they down and they respectfully asked to be served, and they were denied, and they stayed there. And people spit on them, they jeered them, they tried to physically hurt them too, and their directive, their goal was to not respond with, not to meet anger with anger, not to meet violence with violence. They took it all peacefully. And it was a way Martin Luther King saw that could appeal to people's conscience. Like, these people at the lunch counter are not asking for anything unreasonable. They're asking to be served like everyone else. And even though they were being disrespected and mistreated, they still were respectful and they didn't attack. And so people then all across the East Coast in many lunch counters used the same tactic. And it did appeal to, people's sense of conscience. And then finally Woolworths gave in and said that they could be served. Mm-hmm. So that was a way where, it wasn't people yelling at people. I agree that doesn't accomplish much because no one's listening to anyone. And so I think that was a good model of a way to accomplish something.
Yeah. Well, I'm always looking for new perspectives on things, and especially from folks who have experienced these things. Obviously, you've been involved in certain, I'm sure, gatherings around the country for particular causes. Is there one in particular, because you've got 26 in this book, 26 different acts of goodness, if you will, but is there a particular cause that you have stood up for and continue to do so in our society?
Well, in terms of one of the actions Well, like I had mentioned, the Go Local, it's something I try to do in my life. And as for nurture, I, you know, a lot of ways to do that. I try and do those things in my life. You know, as far as a particular cause, where I live, fracking is an issue. And I have gone to various, marches and talks, and I've written in to politicians. And actually, in New York State, we were able to ban fracking. And so it was very gratifying that we were able to do that. And as far as the marches go, like, what happens too is that people who believe in the same thing, they come together, they can share resources, ideas, and when you do come together, like, an idea is stronger when you share it. And so when a lot of people come out in support of something, you know, that's another energetic thing. It builds a momentum, and, you know, something you can see, too. It's not something invisible. You know, you can see crowds of people.
Right.
And, you know, that has value, and it was able to make change.
Absolutely. Well, when we get around the corner from the break, we're going to continue our conversation here. We're talking with Tanya Zabinski. She is the author of Peace, Love, Action, Everyday Acts of Goodness from A to Z. And you are listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And I suppose that we are sort of participating and sort of creating a call to action, sort of an activist type of thing, and that is 2020, the year of perfect vision, where we're trying to continue to search for those new ways of living so that everybody can know that there are choices and have the knowledge of those choices to help make their dreams come true. And we'll be back right after this.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. And hey, thanks for staying with us as we continue talking with our very special guest, Tanya Zabinski. She's the author of Peace, Love, Action, Everyday Acts of Goodness from A to Z. I like the way that this is laid out, too, by the way, folks, because when you go into the book and you go into the first few pages here, you're actually going to see the breakdown in the book of each of the sections, each of the individuals. You'll actually know who some of the people are who are featured in this particular work, so that you can go there, as well as subjects, like as she mentioned, actually, I should say you, Tanya, mentioned, of course, Dr. Martin Luther King and the letter D for dream. We also have E is for empower, F is for feed, G is for go local, H is for help, and so on and so on and so on, all the way to Z. Do it with zest. There you go. Do it with zest. Absolutely. But one of the things that I think we would do well to look at, and at any time, being grateful, being thankful, and tell us a little bit about that particular letter, because I don't know about you, I get the sense sometimes when I'm watching people stand up and voice their particular perspective that sometimes they aren't very grateful or thankful for the things that they already have. I know that there are things they want. You know, we want equanimity in our societies. But at the same time, there are certain parts of our society that are pretty doggone good. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, the person I have representing the Action Thank is Andrew Bankowski. And he's still alive. When he was 5 years old, his family and a million others sent from their homeland of Poland to live in Siberia. And as you know, it's very cold there. They also had so little food that at times they didn't eat for days. And after living in Siberia for 2 years, political conditions shifted, and Andrew and his family were able to leave. So even though those 2 years were so harsh, Andrew Bienkowski was able to look back and say that he was actually thankful for the life lessons he learned there. And he said if he couldn't find anything for which to be thankful, he feels like all his hard times would have been in vain. So he has a book, his own book. It's called One Life to Give. And in it, he challenges us to practice what he calls radical gratitude, which is practicing gratitude not only for wonderful things, but even for difficult things. And, well, obviously no one looks forward to difficult times, but Bienkowski says if we can recognize value in struggle, we can see the silver lining. Our gratitude often heals and strengthens us.
Mm.
I mean, he also encourages us to be thankful for the small things. So when he was in Siberia, his mother and grandmother were really good examples. And so even during all that hardship, they were both able to find small wonders. And every day they worked to pass that appreciation on to their kids. Morning dew in a spider web, a beautiful sunrise, all those things, all those kinds of things. So Bienkowski says these little things are opportunities to celebrate the beauty of life, of nature, and they're a reminder that there's still good in the world. So all kinds of things we can be thankful for. And in the book, after each mini-bio, there's also a What You Can Do section.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the What You Can Do suggestions is to keep a gratitude journal. And whatever we dwell on grows, whatever we give our attention to. So if we every day count things that we're grateful for, then the things we can be grateful for grow and grow and grow. And if you do it at night, like, it puts you to bed in a good frame of mind, and I think it helps you sleep, you know, before a meal, saying grace. That's a act of gratitude, and it actually can help you even digest your food better if you're in a state of gratitude rather than, I don't know, rushing or some other sort of state.
Exactly. I know that going along with that concept of gratitude and thankfulness, forgiveness is another area where they're showing, the science is now showing where, you know, if you can forgive others, let alone forgive yourself, mm-hmm. that has quite an impact energetically on your physiology, your biology, if you will, and it can make a big difference. One of the other things that I thought was really kind of neat in specifically in this particular place as far as thankfulness, this particular quote from Andrew, and it goes like this: if we can live in gratefulness today, the regrets of the past and the worries of the future disappear. By practicing gratefulness, we move out of the self. We slow down and appreciate the present. And the more we practice gratefulness, the more grateful we become. And, you know, it's interesting. I remember going through some personal growth programs back in the 80s and 90s, and they used to talk about instituting new practices in your life, new habits, if you will, and that it would take about 30 days. I don't know if that's changed. Maybe it's now down to 21 days if your intent is clear and so forth. But usually they would say if you can do it every day for 30 days, it becomes second nature, if you will. It becomes a habit. And that's a, you know, and especially if you're let's say writing in your thankful or great gratitude journal, or just saying thank you to the people around you, that kind of thing, or saying grace before a meal, whether you're sitting alone or with a group of people, there is something to be said for how it can affect your longevity. You know, again, this is now science and the medical community are kind of showing that. And I don't know about you, but I was watching this one documentary not too long ago about the kidnapping of, I don't know, it was 7 or 8 or 9 school-age kids, young kids. And the documentary not only took a look at what happened back in, I think it was the 70s, but then, of course, had some of the kids, now adults, on the program, on the documentary, talking about their experiences and how their lives were changed and so forth. And one of the gentlemen basically had the opportunity, after one of the kidnappers had served his time and was released, he went to meet him to forgive him, and described the great release he experienced by doing that. This huge weight, he says, it just went away. And I often think about that in terms of a lot of these wonderful things like gratitude and being thankful and so forth, and how that could just, it really could change our lives individually, but then, and you, when you get into your tribes, it's going to change the tribe, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah. Yes.
And it doesn't mean that you don't care about the cause that you're supporting. Maybe it gives a different perspective on how to approach. Have you found that to be the case, where you might have started out maybe going in one direction with a cause, and then as new ideas come in, you say, gee, maybe we should, let's take a look at a little different approach. And I'm curious about patience. What about that in terms of taking on a cause? Isn't patience part of the process? Because if you go out today and you protest, are you expecting for the powers that be to, okay, we'll change the situation right now? It doesn't happen that way, does it?
Right. I mean, we're coming upon the 100th anniversary of women having the right to vote, and that didn't happen even in the lifetime of a lot of the women who were working towards it. So, yeah, patience is a virtue, and sometimes things do take time to unfold, you know, even though we know, you know, we know what's right. I know there was in England when chimney sweeps, they used small children to clean out the chimneys, and they were getting caught in the chimneys and stuck there. And many of them would die stuck in the chimneys. There was a man trying to end that practice, but that took 100 years. It's obvious that it shouldn't be done anymore.
Yeah.
But still, it goes on and on and on. It can take a long time. So after putting this book together and studying the biographies of the 25 people who are in it, I did see patterns emerge. And persistence is one of the virtues, one of the qualities that they all seem to share, because, for instance, Jane Goodall is in the book. She sat for hours and hours and hours and hours and months, years, studying the chimpanzees in Tanzania, and it wasn't something that she snapped her fingers and, you know, it unfolded. I mean, the civil rights movement, it's not like that's over either. You know, there's still... it's an ongoing exercise, and working towards something, and working towards, you know, the vision of a peaceful, loving, thriving planet that works for all. So, yeah, patience and persistence are definitely two qualities that are helpful to develop.
Yeah. It is something to keep in mind. And of course, what I have found interesting, let's say when we talk about the foods that we eat, and of course, organic is now a common label we see on a lot of our produce and other products in the stores. We didn't see it maybe 20 years ago. But at the same time, this was what was interesting when I was talking with some vintners here in the Santa Barbara County area. They said organic growing was just the way that you grew things 100 years ago. That's just the way that it was done. They didn't call it wasn't anything special. It was just the way it was done. And of course, now, you know, there's the whole certification and this and that and the other thing, and you've got to get it approved by the organic board and on and on and on. And it's like, wow, okay. But at the same time, you still have those people who want to get on the bandwagon but don't want to have to go through the certification. And I've said this time and time again, people can slap a label on anything and call it whatever they want. And we even had a strawberry grower here on the Central Coast who got caught doing that. And it turns out their strawberries weren't organic. So that's another interesting aspect of it, too. Sometimes you do get people who get involved with some of these groups, and they're actually there. They don't really give a hoot about the issues as much as they're almost like a rabble rousers. How do you guard against something along those lines, or is there really anything you can do for people who just really aren't concerned about the cause per se? They're just there to stir up trouble,
or to make money off of,
or to make money, yeah,
trend. Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and move on to some other things here. By the way, how did you come up with the idea for compiling this book? And then to dovetail off of that, how did you come up with the 26 people? Because I know there are more than 26 activists who have existed down through history.
It's unending.
I know. But how did you choose? How did you choose to write this, put this together, and how did you pick the 26 people that are featured in your work?
Okay. Well, putting it together, all my life interested. I love reading biographies about people who inspire me, and so over the course of time, I just read a lot of biographies and. And actually, okay, so Wangari Maathai, she, one of the people in the book, she stands for P is for plant. She started the Green Belt Movement in Kenya. She mobilized thousands of women to plant millions of trees and stopped the desertification and, you know, regreened Kenya, a big part of Kenya, and it even moved into other countries in Africa. And I read her autobiography, and after I read that, I drew the picture. It has a pair of an adult pair of hands planting next to a child's pair of hands planting, and I put the word plant under it, and so I collected a lot of these. Created a lot of these pictures that went with different people, and I put them all into a book. And looking at it, it just felt like it was missing something. So it was my husband's idea for me to add the biographies to go with all the people, all the pictures that they had inspired. And so it just kind of organically grew, and then it was the publisher who had the idea that I love of adding the "what you can do" sections onto it. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you an interesting thing in the process of in the evolving of the book. The biographies were heavy on white males, and there are a lot of white males doing fabulous things, but. It was out of proportion to other people. I hadn't looked for these biographies in any sort of systematic way. It was just kind of, what I ran into. And so for a published book, the publisher and I wanted to make it more proportional with men and women and different races. And so then it was, easy to find different people from different backgrounds, to fill some of those words or some of those letters that I needed. Mm-hmm. It was like putting a puzzle piece together to try to find words and people who fit them. But I feel really happy that is more representational of a cross-section of different kind of people.
So it's not quite 50-50 male to female?
I think it is 50-50.
Is it? Okay.
Maybe it's one more woman. I'm not. It's pretty close.
Well, I think that's a good thing. I think the thing that really gets me is the stories that are starting to come out here in the 21st century. And I know some came out in the 20th, but mostly in the 21st, and movies and books and so forth, about the wonderful and critical contributions that women have made in our society. That absolutely is like, most of the times it's, I never knew that. Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's incredible. You know, especially when it comes to, for example, the Apollo project, the Apollo program. That blew me away. But then, of course, there are others as well. And it's like, wait a minute, why haven't we known this? Well, obviously, because you've had the male-dominated patriarchal society, and those things are... matter of fact, I even throw this one out, that the true first, if you will, pope of the church should never have been Peter. It should have been Mary Magdalene, because she was the first person, let alone woman, to recognize who the Messiah was following his crucifixion and resurrection.
Yeah.
The other guys, they were walking down the road, came across him, and basically, hey, can you show us where the nearest pub is? We're kind of drowning our sorrows because our best friend just died. And they didn't know who he was. And I thought, boy, the people who put this book together, they screwed up, because they should never have left that in. Because quite honestly, that gives an incredible amount of credit to her, to the female half of the species in that respect. That's neither here nor there at this particular point. When you think about the work that you have been about, the activism that you have been about in your lifetime, can you share with us some progress you have seen in your lifetime, maybe not necessarily due to the work you have done directly, but to the work that has been done collectively by activists across this country, let alone around the world?
Well, I think having Marianne Williamson running for president, running for being a Democratic candidate, is a sign that people are becoming more open-minded to hearing the word love in politics, or consciousness in politics. I think that's a sign of evolution. That's a good question you ask, and I'm sure if I had time to think about it, there's more I could think of.
Sure.
Well,
I ask the question because it's one of those things that we think about sometimes, but we really don't do anything about. And again, throwing into the mix patience, you know, being patient with your cause. I mean, you know, I was interviewing Jacques Fresco, who was a visionary futurist, and he would design, he was an architect who designed futuristic cities that we would live in. And he had a three-pillared concept for those civilizations. And one of them was, one of the pillars was a resource-based economy, if you will, and that the resources belonged to all the people. You'd still have your distribution or organizations, if you will, but they didn't own it and they didn't control it. They just distributed that which the public owned, and so on and so forth. And I would say to him in our first interview, I says, well, do you think this will happen in your or my lifetime? He says, well, first of all, and he was in his 90s. I says, it won't happen in my lifetime, and it probably won't happen in yours, because unless unless our society raises its consciousness above where it is now, it won't happen. And I was disappointed, because I wanted to have it happen right now. It would have been great.
Well, honestly, I think indigenous societies did live in that manner. The Inuit, I know, I've read accounts, if a seal was killed, they shared it with the whole community. So I think, indigenous societies lived more in that way. And, maybe it's going back to that kind of connection with the earth, with nature, and with our fellow human beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that we have a long way to go. There's no question. There's still so much more for us to do. And what's really frustrating for me on one level is the fact that it seems like we've been spinning our wheels for over 200 years. It's like I interviewed a gentleman who wrote a book about a new revolution, if you will, and that we need to have we need to return to a what was the word that he used? A reasonable form of government. And I said, okay, so first question I asked him, I says, when was the last time we had that kind of government? He says, well, it was about 3 minutes after the Declaration of Independence was signed, or the Constitution was signed. And then it was over. Because as soon as that was done and the various groups started to coalesce, you had people going after their own agendas, you know, making sure that their ox didn't get gored, but somebody else's did. And I think that it's unfortunate. I mean, even today, it's good grief. It's got to be 100 times worse than it was back then, because people in the political system are more interested in their party survival and winning and achieving and so forth than they are about what the people want, what the people deserve. And that's what's really unfortunate right now in our society, is that it's my tribe versus your tribe, and my tribe's right. I don't care what you tell me. I don't care what you show me. I don't care what facts you show me. My tribe is right. And I'm wondering how that plays into being an activist.
You mean dealing with people who have that mindset?
Exactly.
How do you,
oh my goodness, how do you get past that?
Well, I have a quote from Luke. It says, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. So, somehow love does have a power. And maybe it doesn't overtly change people, but it does. I just heard a story on the radio. A woman had a daughter she had adopted, and when that, As a young person, the adopted daughter had experienced a lot of neglect, and as she became a teenager, she still had tantrums and threw things and put holes in walls, and she was very hard to live with. And the mother did her best to, as a mother, you have to put some kind of boundaries, but still, she tried to show love, as much love as she could possibly. When she was with her, when she wasn't with her, she just tried to send love and feel love. And that daughter grew out of it. So there is some power about with love. It changes things.
Yeah.
The
constant in the universe is change. However, love is the one constant that doesn't. It's always there. It's, you know, and I think that's pretty cool from that standpoint.
Yeah, it's always there. It's waiting for us to align with it so that it can work through us.
What what about your philosophy, the philosophy that you live by? And maybe you might share, you may also share that with your husband and your family. But what did you grow up believing?
I grew up Catholic, but both of my parents were also very open-minded towards learning alternative views on the world. My mom did yoga, and my dad was interested in Zen. So I was exposed to a lot of alternative ideas growing up, although I did have the foundation of going to church every Sunday and going through communion and confirmation and all those things. My practice today, I do daily meditation and yoga, and I see it as trying to, align myself with try and connect with basically the power of love and live it in my life.
Well, we certainly would encourage others to do the same. What have you on the horizon? Are there any any activist activities that you have coming up that you're going to participate in somewhere else in the country? Or is it, especially when it comes to winter in New York, just staying warm?
Well, I'll be... I have some book events lined up, and the way my husband and I have made our living is going to art shows, art festivals, and selling our wares and through our website. So just continuing with that, and through our network of meeting all these people on the road at art shows and festivals, we have a wide network of friends, so we're connecting with like-minded people at these festivals and just sharing our work, our story, and going from there.
How important is it, this is kind of going back to the activism and so forth, but how important is it, even as someone who wants to, quote-unquote, change the world, which is what we want to do too, okay? And so we're doing our little part with this program in our own little activist way. But how important is it for us to get out of our echo chambers and listen to other perspectives?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's a natural thing. They say birds of a feather flock together, and it is natural to do that. At the same time, there is value in being around birds of a different feather and learning about them. That's always a kind of opportunity or challenge to try to create those types of environments where you can mix with different kinds of people. I'm interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And would you say that it's something that's important that we need to do in order to really know what our intentions are in our activism?
Maybe so. I don't know if you've ever been, if you've traveled to other countries, when you're there, you get a different perspective on your own country. So, whenever you mix with people with different backgrounds and beliefs, it does help you get another fresh perspective on what your own beliefs are. And a lot of times what happens is that across different religions, there are similar parallel things that pop up. I had read to you the quote from Luke about loving your enemies, and in the Sikh religion, one of their teachers, Guru Nanak, one of his quotes is, I see no stranger, I see no enemy. And, you know, I'm sure I could find quotes from other religions that say the same thing. So sometimes, yeah, I think there might be, the religions have different names and the people are dressed in different ways and have different practices, but a lot of the time the message boils down to the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And that message is, from your perspective, as an activist, helping people to make this world a better place, what is the core message that you would share with any person who wants to change the world, anybody who wants to get involved to make this a better place? What would be the one message among the 26, if you will, or others, that you would give to people?
Well, to realize that no matter who they are, there are decisions they make each day that can lean towards love and contribute to peace. And they can be any age, any race, any religion, any sex, anywhere on the planet. And they can be a scientist, singer, cook, a radio show host, a student, a teacher, anything. You know, any job, anything. And if they're open to open to learning, then they'll find ways to contribute to peace.
Yeah. Well, I would encourage people to do just that and help to contribute to peace. But again, as I mentioned at the outset of the program, that whole aspect of peace has to begin with me and you, and making peace with ourselves, making peace with what sort of like the two halves of who and what we are, as they say, the light and the dark side or the shadow side of us, that we all have that, but that doesn't mean we have to live there. You know, what's that Native American story about two wolves, you know, and which, you know, they're going to fight. And which one's going to win? And the statement is made, well, whichever one you feed. So I think that's really important. What about, before we wrap things up here, I want to ask you about getting drawn into I'll use this term, the negative energy that often comes about. And this has nothing to do with those people who may do this. They may get involved in some of these activist movements for money or just to stir up trouble. But in terms of the energy that's generated, okay, which is really important, I would think, and maintaining your intent. But how do you protect yourself from the onslaught, if you will, of that negative energy of the people who criticize the actions of protesters or activists or people who just care, you know, and so forth? Is there a way to do that, to protect yourself internally, spiritually, in that respect, so you don't get lost in that?
So you're saying, for instance, how would someone, if they were doing the lunch counter sit-ins, how would they protect themselves from the people who are jeering or spitting or things like that?
And it isn't the physical activity that I'm referring to. I'm talking about the energy. How do you protect yourself?
By not seeing them as the enemy, which, you know, might be difficult to do. But there is a story from that lunch counter sit-in that one of the freshman four, when he was sitting at the counter, he saw elderly woman, and he felt a white woman, and she was looking at him, and he felt her beady eyes staring at him, like thinking, he imagined that she was saying to him, "What do you think you're doing sitting at the counter here?" And he imagined her to be an enemy. And when she got up to leave the lunch counter, she came over to him. She put her hands on his shoulders, and she said to him, "It's about time someone did something like this." So she was, you know, encouraging of him, but in his mind, he had imagined that she was, he had imagined that she was against what he was doing, and so it was like a kind of double take for him. Like, he was surprised to see, wow, she's behind me. And so maybe that's what we can do, is just, well, it's not just to protect ourselves, just, well, if we can trust there's a love inside of us, like filling us and holding us up, and if we can, yeah, connect to that and feel it, that can be a bolster for us.
Well, I think that you have gone a long way to help us to better understand what it means to be someone who genuinely cares, and to show us those people down through history who genuinely care about others. These people that you focused on, certainly they were not self-centered per se, although they themselves obviously were probably, if you were to read their biographies, which you have, probably suffered their own indignities, their own issues in that regard, and overcame them. But it wasn't just for themselves. It was for others like them who had been deemed to be different and separate from the rest of society. One gentleman I wanted to ask you about real quickly here, you actually have in the book here, under the letter K, K is for Neil, Colin Kaepernick. And I know that a lot of people are really cranked up over the whole issue of his taking a knee during the national anthem at the football games. And I get that. But why is it that that's not his right to express himself in that fashion? I don't see. Actually, I consider kneeling as a Catholic growing up, that's supposed to be a good thing, to kneel, as showing respect at one level.
I agree. I mean, I can't think of any more respectful act, yeah, that anyone can do. And I like to use the comparison of the freedom fighters, the self-proclaimed freedom fighters, the people who started the Boston Tea Party, and they actually dressed themselves as Native Americans. They disguised themselves as Native Americans. They went on board the boat. They threw tea into the water, to protest the taxes that were being paid.
Mm-hmm.
So, in comparison, Colin Kaepernick is not disguising himself. He's, fully open of who he is. He's not destroying any property. He's actually, kneeling respectfully to show his, to make his point.
Right.
And the issue isn't taxes. The issue is being treated equally.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I personally can't think of a more nonviolent, respectful way to make a statement than the way he did it.
Yeah. And I'm not going to take sides on the issue. All I know is that I thought this was America, where you had the freedom to express yourself as long as it didn't interfere with or infringe
harm someone
else. And he didn't do that. He just said, "Hey, I'm going to take a knee," which, again, I think that taking a knee Isn't that what they do? Isn't that what they did in the medieval days under the royalty, where if you're going to be knighted, so to speak, and I'm not saying that's what he was doing, but you're supposed to kneel before the king or queen as they tap you on each shoulder with the sword, saying, "I knight thee," blah, blah, blah. And it's a sign of respect. So I don't know. It's been made very controversial, and I'm just trying to understand it myself. And I know that we live in a particular period in time where a lot of people don't know this. I did some research on the national anthem, and very early on in the early part of the 20th century. Are you ready for this one, Tanya? When they would sing the national anthem, they would stick their right hand out and up at a 45-degree angle. Does that sound familiar? They used to do that. And then when the Nazis came into power in Germany, they decided to drop that gesture and put the hand on the heart. But that was the salute. That was the salute that they used to extend when they would sing the national anthem in the early 1900s, all the way up to. Yeah. I didn't know it either. I was shocked myself, but they changed it. And I thought, why? Why would you change it? What are you ashamed of? That's another thing. I find it interesting that I see a lot of protesters sometimes, and a lot of times they're doing violent things. You would think that somebody who's an activist, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you are one, they cover their faces. I would think, wouldn't you want to be proud to be known as someone who is standing up for this cause or that cause, even if you're causing destruction? Why would you be ashamed of that?
Well, I mean, my book is about peaceful activism.
Yes, I understand.
Absolutely.
And I just kind of put that forth. You don't have to answer the question. It just was perplexing to me when I would see these kinds of things happen. And I just sit here going, really? Come on. You know, it just seems to me that if you're going to take a stand for something, then you should be willing to put your face out. I look at that in the same way as some of these extremist groups around the world. You know, when they go in and they do whatever it is they do, they cover up their faces, or in some cases they wear a hood. It's like, You mean you're ashamed to stand up and put your face out there and say, you betcha I am for this cause or that cause or the other? And it's like, oh, we don't want to get caught. It's like, really? I think that I would think that would be a badge of honor that you were to get caught, and you could then stand up, you know, and say whatever you're going to say. Again, I'm going far field, and I apologize for that. It just seems to me that if we're going to stand up and make a stand for a particular cause, we need to be proud of doing so, but we need to do it in a peaceful way. I mean, your book talks about that, and it's right there in the title: Peace, Love, Action, Everyday Acts of Goodness from A to Z. Tanya Zubinski is my guest. Tell me about these are all your illustrations, which, by the way, I'm really impressed by the drawings, the imagery, the illustrations in here. Obviously, they're very, very accurate in that respect. How long does it usually take you to draw one of these images?
Well, it's interesting because sometimes one will come together quickly, and other times one will take longer. You know, it might take a day, it might take a week, and they're all silkscreen printed. So then, you know, working out the colors can. Sometimes I'll experiment with different colors, and could be a day or a week or longer.
Yeah. How has your family felt about your activism over the years?
Supportive, and you know, Honestly, I mean, you keep calling me an activist, and part of me feels, well, like I'm not really doing that much out in the forefront. And at one time when I was younger, I felt, honestly, that even though I wanted to be an artist, that it's not, if I want to help, be helpful in the world, there's more helpful things I could do, like being a teacher or a doctor, something in the medical field, or, you know, maybe even a politician. And so I didn't really want to let myself be an artist because I felt like that's, you know, you're playing around with colors and shapes, and while other people, you know, don't have a place to live, can't eat, don't have education. And so, over time, there's a quote, ask not what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is more people who feel alive.
Absolutely.
And I do feel, though, that there's an intersection, like when what makes you feel alive can also overlap with what the world needs. And so I feel like this book is a way that I can use my talents and overlap with what the world needs. And like I said, I don't necessarily feel like I'm, you know, making sweeping changes, but I'm contributing my gifts in the way that I can. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in its humble way, it's what I'm trying to do.
Absolutely. Well, in the last couple of moments that we have here on the program, I want to thank you so much for sharing with us so much about the work that you're doing and the ideas that you are trying to convey, which are very simple ones. Peace, love, action. Everyday acts of goodness from A to Z. Tanya, I want to thank you so much. And I also encourage you, if you want to get out of the snow and come out here to Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio to continue talking about these and other ideas as well. But I have three final questions for you. And as I say, we are coming up on the end of the program, but the three final questions are as follows. You may have addressed them somewhat during the interview, but I like to ask them directly. First one is, who is Tanya Zabinski?
Who is Tanya Zabinski?
Yes.
I'm not sure how to answer that.
Just whatever comes to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a daughter, wife, mother, sister, community member, artist, friend, gardener, bicyclist, skier, person in this big world.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Well, shining a light on good things that people are doing and encouraging people to share in the vision of this peaceful, loving, thriving world that works for all, and use their gifts and talents and energies in a way that builds on this vision.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I feel it has to do with sharing beauty and joy.
Well, Tanya Zabinski, I thank you again so much for joining us on the program, and I look forward to having you on the program in the near future to talk more about this. Is there going to be a sequel with another 26, A to Z?
Well, I sure have plenty of people to fill in the pages of that book, so there very well could be a sequel, yes.
We look forward to that. And again, we thank you so much for being a part of this program, as well as for the work that you're doing. And as you pointed out quite well earlier, you are an activist doing whatever it is that you are doing. And I think that's something that we tend to get lost in, that we think that it has to be this grandiose activity that is going to, as we keep saying, change the world. And in some instances, it doesn't have to be grandiose. It's just, you know, whatever it is that you can do, do, right?
Yeah, in your daily life.
Even if it's just shoveling snow, right?
Exactly.
Well, wonderful. And again, I thank you so much for being with us here on the program, and much success to you, as well as to the work that you are doing. And we certainly hope that we can encourage people to be involved in both whatever kind of activism, but also safe and peaceful activism, because I think that's the only way we're ever going to get anything done.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Tanya Zabinski, for joining us. Again, the title of the book is Peace, Love, Action. It is everyday acts of goodness from A to Z, website where people can go to get more information.
PeaceLoveAction.com.
There you go. PeaceLoveAction.com. Go there, find out more, and we hope that you will join us again here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And until next time, love, Talal.